Good evening, I'm Lister Sinclair, and this is Ideas.
I feel rather proud that mine should be the first voice to be heard on this program. My job as a naval nurse is tremendously interesting. There isn't a nurse in the world who wouldn't be proud to care for our Navy lads. They make Canada's Navy a force with which to be reckoned. As patients, well...
World War II was a time of real personal sacrifice and courage. But it was also a time of hype and glory. Those wartime propaganda broadcasts, for instance. People on them were well rehearsed in promoting the war effort, like that Navy nurse in Newfoundland. But that was half a century ago. What would those people say today about the war? The nurses, for instance. Especially those who went overseas and worked in the casualty clearing stations, the operating rooms, the wards, the hospital ships. Today, what memories of those days do those nurses still hold inside them? What is their sense of war?
I think war is hell, you know. And I think perhaps it is best that people know. I don't believe they've been told enough about it to understand just how grim war is. Somebody once said, "Oh my, you had a wonderful trip." And you know, I could have slapped her. She didn't realize what it all meant. It wasn't just a trip. I wasn't on a trip.
Tonight on Ideas, A Sense of War, prepared by Doug MacDonald.
Last Sunday morning, a smoothly functioning organization deposited soldiers in this eastern port from all sections of Canada, placed them on board ship, and sent them away with the precision of clockwork. The business of loading went forward in the...
We had put on our 40-pound pack and were marching to the ship that was going to take us overseas in Halifax. And my pal fell down, and they wouldn't let me pick her up. She fell flat in her face because it was so heavy you couldn't get up. And passing us on the way were all the troops, the Royal Canadian Army Service Corps. They were transported in vans while the nursing sisters were marching towards the ship.
And then they went into the ships, and many of them felt for the first time in their lives the rise and fall of the Atlantic under their feet.
I'm from near Maple Creek in Saskatchewan. Being a prairie chicken raised on the prairies, it was a new experience to me to land in Halifax Harbor, and it was wild.
Slate gray ships move into the stream, and in line astern, set their course eastward into a gray fog of the North Atlantic. And quickly they merge as gray smudges into the Atlantic mist.
It was awe-inspiring to see all these gray, somber ships of all kinds, which were spread out around the whole harbor. And I must say, that gave me my first impression, really, of what war was going to be like, or the start of being in an active war scene. I was really excited. It was a real adventure at that point.
For the nurses aboard those slate gray ships, this was all new. But they weren't the first Canadian nurses in a war. As far back as the Battle of the Plains of Abraham in Quebec, and even before, women in religious orders cared for the wounded. In fact, that's why later, in England, then in Canada, all military nurses came to be called nursing sisters. By World War II, most people agreed that nurses had earned their place beside the men at war. Most people. Joan DeRay.
My father had been in World War I and gassed in World War I, and he didn't seem to think it was anything out of the ordinary. One of my sisters was quite upset and thought something dire might happen to me, but she was younger than me. The father of a friend said to me, "Oh, Joan, you don't want to get involved in that sort of thing, do you?" And I said, "Yes, I do." At that stage, I didn't care what anyone else said about it. I had made up my mind. But he saw it as something that maybe I shouldn't have been involved in. I think he saw it as something that a nice girl maybe didn't go to, but he wasn't sure.
Back then, many people were sure that nice girls stayed home. But there were some acceptable careers for women. Secretarial work was one. Another was teaching. And, of course, there was nursing. Helen Musalem.
in the late 30s and early 40s, we were still in the age for, if I could put it in its basic terms, women did what they were told. And when we graduated from the Vancouver General Hospital, the expectations of a nurse in society at that time was almost as pure as if she'd been in the nunnery. And we were often told by the superintendent of nurses, remember that you are women, but more than that, you are nurses. You must be a perfect woman in a perfect society. It was so unreal. When I went into the armed services, you knew exactly where you were. In the armed services, there is a chain of command. We were officers as well as women. And you really felt like a somebody for a change.
In World War II, nurses, graduates with several years' experience, had a special place. For the first time, there were other women in the Canadian Armed Forces, but they knew the nurses were different. Pat Hamill, not a nurse, was in the Canadian Women's Army Corps.
When I was stationed in Sydney, Nova Scotia, a ship was sunk off the coast. The survivors were brought to the military hospital in Sydney. I can't remember now why I thought I should go in to see these survivors, whether I thought I was going to bring them some comfort or what. But I remember it was quite unlike any movie. They weren't crying, they weren't joking, they weren't laughing. They were stunned, having been in that very cold water for some time, and some of them injured. And I quickly backed out. It was no place for me. It was a place for the nurses.
Many Canadian nursing sisters got their first real taste of war when they arrived in England.
You can expect to hear a plane coming any moment now. I think you can hear that bomber. There's some distant guns on the outskirts. Yes, he's coming. There are the guns. That one was close.
My first night, I landed off the boat and then went up to Birmingham. And here, if it wasn't one of those awful air raids.
Marie Totino.
And I thought, well, isn't this something? So we all went down underneath the big station. And I thought, well, I'm going to stand near the crew because I don't want to get lost. And then finally I asked one of them, what happens if a bomb hits on top of us? Will it come down here? Oh, yes, they said. If you get a direct hit. And then when we came up after it was all over, you could see fires. I'd been in Birmingham before the war. It was really sad, all these fires burning.
It was heartwarming to see the courage of the British people. They told us that we were seeing them now at their worst, but I think they were tired of war, tired of death, tired of people being killed. I had a tremendous respect for them.
All the British people made sacrifices in the war, including the landed gentry. Many lent their country estates to the war effort. Some of their manor houses, surrounded by tents, became doctors and nurses' quarters, operating theatres, wards for the patients. There never seemed to be enough bed space, especially one day in mid-August 1942. Matron Evelyn Pepper was with the No. 1 Canadian General Hospital unit in Horsham, in the south of England.
Everybody was being very quiet. You had a feeling that something was going to happen, but you didn't know what. All the units were saying kind of the same thing. Then we were told a very little bit that we weren't to leave the compound of our hospital. The next morning, we were called very early because casualties were arriving. It was then we heard that the word was Dieppe.
Rooney Peltier speaking to you from London. I spoke on the telephone to our general's headquarters. General A.G.L. McNaughton, commander of the Canadian Army overseas, gave me a statement. combined sea, land, and air forces from the UK, the US, Canada, and the Fighting French have struck a heavy blow at the enemy. And they will do it...
We know now, of course, that we struck no heavy blow at Dieppe. Most of the troops were pinned on the beaches by the heavily armed German fortifications. Of 9,000 Canadian soldiers in the raid, almost 1,000 were killed and 2,000 more taken prisoner. The lucky ones were evacuated back to England. The wounded were sent to hospitals like Horsham, where the nurses were waiting with Canadian matron Nancy Kennedy Reed.
They came in and they were really very badly wounded. And mostly we just started by giving them drinks of hot fluids until the doctors came round and were able to decide who went to the operating room and who didn't. And they were coming in one after the other. And they were coming in with all their equipment on them. And one man said to me, I kicked his clothes under the bed. Don't kick the clothes, he said, we've got our grenades with us. So I went to our quartermaster and told him, and so they collected and took them off. But the girls never thought of that. They, you know, it didn't worry them because they were just so concentrated on the patient, trying to stop bleeding or to assure them a little bit. Some of them didn't want to get into bed because of the white sheets. They felt that they'd been living on the ground for so long, you know, and some of them were just soaked with water.
Well, this is Bob Bowman speaking very quietly from one of our marvelous military hospitals in the south of England, and busy now looking after the casualties from the Dieppe raid. And first to Private Steve Addis of the Royal Hamilton Light Infantry. Come on in, Steve.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say hello to my folks and tell them that I'm okay. I've got a few cuts, but I'm feeling fine and getting better. I think our gang did okay. We landed on Red Beach.
Dieppe is very, very vivid with strong feelings. They're so young, and, you know, you'd go to your patient and wake them up to give them medication, because they all had to have what we called Dagenin in those days. Made them very sick, sulfa. They were in battle for such a short while that they hadn't had time to get dirty or hungry or anything. They went in, and then they were shot at. And they'd say, oh, sister, they were waiting for us. The guns were out of the windows. So they knew all about it. It wasn't kept secret at all. And there was no way they could get in there. I think most of us thought, well, it should never have happened. And these young kids that weren't in battle long enough, because you later on, like the ones that go into battle for two or three weeks, they come back skinny and they need to be shaved and they're a mess, you know, more or less. But Dieppe, they were all clean shaven. That's what bothered me, that they didn't have a chance. Not a chance.
By 1942 and Dieppe, World War II was finally just that, a world war. Some Canadian nurses remained posted in England or back in Canada, like Margaret Allemagne, an RCAF nurse, but others went much farther afield.
They went to France, Belgium, Holland, Germany at the end of the war, and to Italy. Some of them went to Africa. Two were sent from Canada to Hong Kong. They didn't know where they were going, but they were told they had to be ready and had to board a train, and found out when they were in Vancouver that they were sailing off to somewhere. Well, they ended up in Hong Kong and got into all the terrible things that happened over there.
The two nurses were part of a Canadian force sent to strengthen the British garrison in Hong Kong. They arrived on November the 16th, 1941, and went straight to work in a British military hospital, a seemingly untroubled, if exotic, assignment. But within days, the war caught up with Kay Christie and the others at the Hong Kong hospital.
The NBC newsroom in New York. President Roosevelt says,
that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt said...
3 weeks from the day we arrived in Hong Kong, Pearl Harbor was done, and we were done the next morning at 8 o'clock. Bombed, I mean. They'd sent a shell or two over before that, and they used the hospital as a target, you know, to get their aim. And the first shell that came over went through the hospital roof and out the back and into a brick building where the Chinese boys slept. They had quite a staff of Chinese boys at the hospital, which was customary in the Far East. And one young lad was killed in his bed. He never knew what hit him. You know, I thought, what an awful way to go. We were all just shocked. Oh, because of that first hit on the hospital, we had to evacuate the top floor, move all the beds and mattresses and everything down the ground floor. And then after that, we had snipers, so that we had to move out the second floor patients and beds and everything and bring them down on the ground floor. Beds were just jammed in, you know. You have to separate the beds to get beside a patient to give them medication or anything, or do a dressing. On the side of the hospital next to the harbor, they had that all sandbagged to try and protect the hospital. The operating rooms were down in the basement, but at night the place was darkened. You never knew, you know, who'd be coming in, because with the Chinese around, we didn't know a Chinaman from a Japanese. We had seen enough during the fighting to know that the Japanese were kind of savage. They're not the people they are now, and of course they were the military.
Kay Christie had good reason to fear what the Japanese soldiers would do. She'd heard of atrocities in auxiliary hospitals on Hong Kong Island, female volunteers and a British nurse raped, patients bayoneted on their mattresses on the floor. But Nurse Christie and the patients and staff at her hospital were spared. Instead, they and their patients were taken prisoner. The entire hospital was enclosed by a barbed wire fence and called Prisoner of War Camp A. It was a nightmare. Supplies ran short. Bandages and dressings had to be boiled and reused. No antibiotics, no sulfur drugs. Food rations ran low. Hungry patients grew jealous of their share of the food. They insisted the nurses measure each bread slice with a ruler. Then 8 months later, the final blow. The nurses were forced to abandon their patients. They were transferred to a civilian Hong Kong prisoner of war camp. Here, the nurses faced long months of hunger, hardship, and homesickness.
I've often thought about it. We didn't know anybody. We'd been taken away from the only people we knew, from the only Canadians we knew. And yet I guess the whole thing was that there were others in the same boat. I wasn't alone.
Finally, Kay Christie was released back to Canada in a prisoner of war exchange. And there she discovered that no one really understood what kind of war she'd just been through.
I can remember saying once, some months after I got home, that I thought there were an awful lot of Canadians that needed to have a few bombs scattered over Canada, give them an idea of what war was about, because they were just so complacent and they just had no idea of what a war really was about. And, you know, people would ask me questions. I remember this one elderly lady, and she said, well, did you always have enough to eat? I told her about at night when you'd, you know, try to go asleep, but the pangs of hunger would keep you awake, and I said I'd eventually get up and take a little drink of precious water out of a water bottle, and that would do it. And she said, water? And why wouldn't you go to the refrigerator and get yourself a glass of nice cold milk? There's no use trying to talk to people like that.
Canadians may have got that flawed impression of the war, partly from the way it was presented to them. All the really bad news was censored from the letters from servicemen and women abroad. Media coverage was always positive and optimistic. And shortwave broadcasts from overseas were uplifting. And at times like Christmas, even cheery.
Hello, Canada. This is a Canadian nurse speaking from one of the wards. Usually the last place that people want to spend Christmas is in hospitals, but those are my boys being here in my ward, and they certainly don't sound very depressed to me. I want to tell you that we are looking after your boys well, and that we like looking after them, and are doing our best to make their Christmas a real one. I would like to send our love to our people back home, and to tell them that we are happy and thinking of them.
Propaganda aside, that camaraderie was real enough. Nurses and doctors did everything they could to heal the spirits of their patients as well as their bodies.
They realized they were out of the danger and sort of in a peaceful atmosphere for a short while anyway. But they were really very patient and very helpful. Those that could get up used to get up and help the nurses to make the bed. There was a good relationship between the nurses and the patients.
If you're a nurse, you're near so many who need you, who need help, that your little problems just take second place all along, and they should.
Gaëtan Labonte and the other nurses meant more to the patients than medical care.
The patients used to confide in us a lot because they were lonely, and they would show you their pictures, and they would have wives, very often a girlfriend here and there on the other side, but a pet. That always surprised me, that these big, strong men had been to war with a picture of their loved ones and a pet. And I promised myself that if ever I married and had children, I'd make no fuss about pets if they were that important to big, strong men.
One thing that always tickled me was patients are very jealous about the nurses having outside contacts besides them when they're that sick. I think it's hard for them to realize you've got another part of your life. I was going out with an Englishman, and he was one of these people who could always get a line through on the phone when nobody else could. And the phone call would come through to the ward, and the patients would hear about it. And they would make comments, "We hear you're going out with a Limey." They revert back almost to a family situation where everybody wants to know who's doing what and who's going with what. Because, you see, these units were so tied in.
I wrote letters for many of them, you know, at times, back home. And I remember how sad I was when I came back to Montreal and a very nice patient of mine who'd been a long time seriously ill, I'd written to his wife, and he told me he had just divorced. I nearly cried.
Sometimes in the wards, friendship grew into something deeper.
I think the relationships between men and women do not change because there is a war on. I think quite a few of the patients fell in love with the nurses. One of our nurses did marry one of the patients. He was an American who was with the Canadian Army, and they got engaged. And then later, after she went home a year later, she went down to the States and they were married. But it wasn't that common, because most of the people who came to us were so seriously ill, they were sent on home eventually. Some of them weren't. Some went back to the front who never should have. They really weren't well enough.
Most of Canada's military nurses in World War II worked in those British hospitals at some time, or at least they passed through Britain on the way to the war zones. But one group took a different route. They sailed to Africa to work with the South African Military Nursing Service. Elsie Dutton was in the first group. She landed in Cape Town on Boxing Day 1941 and entered a war within a war. War on the human spirit.
One of the very first things that hit us was that the West Indian who was a West Point graduate who had been on our boat for 5 weeks with us was considered a dark man. And because he had been seen with some of the nurses downtown, the rumor went all around Cape Town that the Canadian nurses were mingling with the dark people. And, of course, this was forbidden.
Elsie Dutton was sent to a new, well-equipped military hospital outside Johannesburg, for whites only, mostly British soldiers. Elsie arrived there in time to see segregationist Prime Minister Jan Smuts open the hospital. The hospital staff was all white, of course, except for a few blacks to do the menial chores. Here, too, no mingling allowed between the dark and the white. Elsie Dutton saw no blacks actually mistreated, but Louise Jameson did. Not at that hospital, she worked there, too. It was later when she ran the operating room in a remote hospital for black soldiers, with whites in charge.
One form of discipline that the South African army personnel with me at the hospital had was that if the native orderly did something that was not to his liking, he'd put him in with a dead person, because the natives were very frightened of a dead body, and I guess it had something to do with their religion. That was their form of discipline at the hospital where I was.
They quite looked down on black people. The crime was that they weren't considered equal to the white people, and they weren't considered actually, I suppose, human. In talking about how the nurses thought of that, I don't think they came back with stars in their eyes thinking that something should be changed about that. It's just that gradually, thank God, we have come to the conclusion this won't do. We've got to all be treated the same.
Many of South Africa's soldiers, black and white, in those hospitals had been wounded farther up the continent in the North African Desert Campaign. But in mid-1943, that phase of the war came to an end.
The African war is over. One continent, at least, has been cleansed and purged forever from fascist or Nazi tyranny. The proud German army
Across the Mediterranean, the Allies invaded Sicily. Canadian wounded were sent to a large new hospital in Algeria, now free from German attack. The nurses of No. 15 Canadian General Hospital were sent to this new posting just outside the Arab town of El Arouche. When Marie Totino and the others arrived, they found a vast tent city.
The heat was just... Well, you didn't wear makeup because it fell off with your perspiration. And it was 112 in the shade. And there was no shade except under the tent ropes, I used to say. You just looked absolutely zonked out most of the time. And then some of the girls got sick because of the heat and diarrhea. Then the Canadians arrived, came out to us in ambulances. They had shrapnel and... Some had lost legs on my ward, and they all had wounds of some description, but they were so dead tired by the time they got to us. We fixed them all up and put them to bed and gave them something to sleep on. We went down to our tents, went to bed, and about 9:30, this wind came up. We had a Scirocco, and it blew all the tents down. Clothes, everything was blown away. Anything that wasn't tied down flew across. But we were struggling with these tents, and somebody came down with a lantern. They said, we were all to report to our wards. I went where I worked with the others, and the canvas was all down on top of the patients. And you know, that didn't we even wake them up? They were so tired, dead tired.
So were some nurses from No. 14 Canadian General Hospital Unit. They arrived in El Arouche as casualties. They weren't seriously injured, but they were suffering from fatigue. These nurses had been aboard the Santa Elena, destination Italy. The sea was calm, but there were other perils. The Mediterranean was a hunting ground for enemy subs and planes. One night, the ship was torpedoed. The ship's crew had no emergency training. Nurses Gertrude, Dickey, Jean Wilson, and Marjorie Root were all aboard the Santa Elena that night.
I grabbed my helmet and went up on deck. Well, then we could see that the ship was beginning to sink, and the crew, they didn't know what to do. But the captain got them to start lowering lifeboats.
They said to get into the lifeboats. Well, there was no electricity in the boat, so they had to lower them by hand. So we kept thinking that... The lifeboats would be tipped, And, I mean, they were a little tet, but we got into the water all right. And they were throwing life rafts over for the men.
Peggy Dakin, who was 6 feet tall, there was a cook, got very excited. Now, he was a little Filipino, and I'm sure he wasn't 4 feet tall. So Peggy leaned over the side of the boat with her hand like this and picked the little guy up and put him in the center of the boat. He was rescued.
They were all rescued, but it had been a narrow escape.
It was rather exciting in a way, but you had to calm other people who were more upset than yourself. And they were really upset. I'm a bit of a fatalist, you know. I just felt, well, if you're going to be hit, you're going to be hit. It was rather exciting in a way, but you had to calm other people who were more upset than yourself, and they were really upset. I'm a bit of a fatalist, you know. I just felt, well, if you're going to be hit, you're going to be hit. I guess it just wasn't our time to go. It's as simple as that.
The nurses of number 40.